Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening. This is Terry Dodd, and this is Walls in Our Minds. Certainly glad to be with you tonight. Hopefully, my co-host, Red Beckman, will be joining us shortly. We already have online our guest tonight, Dr. Paul Prentice. But before I introduce Dr. Prentice, I'd like to open us with a prayer. Please pray with me. Almighty Yahweh, Father God of heaven, we just are humble whenever we come before you, Father, because we know that we wouldn't have a chance to have an audience with you if it wasn't for the gift that you gave us in your Son, Yahushua. Some know him as Jesus the Christ. And we just ask you to fill us with your Spirit this night. We ask you to go before us in everything that we do and we say. We pray that what we do here tonight will glorify you. We pray that you will take control of our lips and our thoughts, and that you will help us to bring forward a message that will be heard loud and clear and amongst our listeners. And we just pray that you lift up Red tonight, and lift up Dr. Prentice, and go before us, fill us with your Spirit, and have your Spirit watch over this show tonight. In the name of your Son, we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Well, I see that Red Beckman has joined us as well. Red?
I am here. I'm on.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I'd like to bounce right in and introduce Dr. Prentice. This is Dr. Paul Prentice. Dr. Prentice.
Hello, Terry. Hello, Red.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting program, I'm sure, and so I want to welcome you along with an audience out there, I'm sure, that are going to be benefited by what we talk about here tonight. That's the goal of the program, is that we help to enlighten people, and that's what's going to happen tonight.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Prentice, yes. You have degrees in mathematics and agricultural economics, and you've been an economist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture under President Reagan. I believe that you've also had some time as an adjunct with von Mises Institute. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. I'm what's called an associated scholar with the von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama.
And now you've taken a position as a professor with CTU. Tell us about that.
Sure. Professor of economics at Colorado Technical University. And Colorado Tech is a very career-oriented, very practical, very market-oriented, very business-oriented college.
Now, you and I got introduced by Senator Kent Lambert here in Colorado, the more I find out about him, the higher my esteem goes for him, but I really appreciated him making this introduction. And I hope, he got the notice tonight, and maybe we'll call in and even participate in a conversation at some point. He introduced you to me as the founder or one of the founders of the Pikes Peak Economics Club, and suggested that we get together because he knew that, that I have a passion for sound money. And I appreciated you sending me one of your recent articles on debased currency and debased culture that goes with that, why America needs sound money. So what else would you like for our listeners to know about you before we get started into the conversation tonight?
Oh, that's enough. I like to say that as an agricultural economist, I have the best of all possible worlds because I have all the theoretical training of regular economists, but also experience in real-world markets. So it's a very very valuable degree.
Well, you know, in this country today, the government tends to follow what is known as Keynesian economics. And I know that you're a student of Austrian economics, and maybe that's a place to start this conversation tonight, is to try to give our listeners a little bit of an understanding of what the difference between those two things are and why this has been a dangerous and continues to be an extremely dangerous path for us to follow in this country.
Sure. That's correct. In the regular economics program at the University of Connecticut, I did study Keynesian economics. And when I went to work first in Washington, D.C., I learned that everything I had learned there was false, because everything they were trying to do before Reagan under Jimmy Carter was not working. They were printing money. The government was spending money. That was just making things worse, that unemployment was rising while inflation was rising, and that was not supposed to happen under the Keynesian paradigm. So that sent me on a bit of a philosophic and intellectual journey to study deeper level of economics, and eventually came to the supply side, or started reading them, and started reading Milton Friedman out of the Chicago School, and then the natural progression of that, Terry, was all the way over to the hardcore free market economics of the Austrian school. And that's where I've landed and been studying that for, I don't know, 20 years now, 30 years.
Can you help our listeners understand the difference?
Sure, the difference is that Keynesian economics is really not really economics once it's fully understood. It's disguised political theory. It's really basically disguised Marxism, and it's given an academic sort of veneer. And Austrian economics is extremely hardcore, based on property rights, very limited government, very much the founding principles of America. So very free market oriented compared to the command and control of the Keynesian school.
Well, we mentioned in our conversation earlier today that I got a tip today, and I haven't heard the video or seen the video on it yet, but apparently Glenn Beck interviewed G. Edward Griffin. And in that conversation, they apparently spent a good half hour talking about the disease known as the Federal Reserve. And I don't know that we want to spend a lot of time talking about the people who started that, or are necessarily the Jekyll Island creature thing. But what we might talk about is how Keynesian economics benefits those banksters that own the Federal Reserve.
Absolutely. It's no accident that what happened time sequentially was in 1913, the simultaneous institution of the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Reserve System really destroyed two of our creator endowed rights. One is the right to our property, and the other one is an implied right, a right to a sound currency. Because without a sound currency, you can't really enjoy your property. Your property is no way of valuing it or have any meaning. You can't engage in meaningful commerce or trade when you don't have a sound currency. So what happened is a system was set up whereby the private banking cartel, the Federal Reserve System, it's nothing federal about it, a private banking cartel was allowed to take over the constitutional role to, quote, coin money and regulate the value thereof. That was Congress's role. So they basically outsourced that to this private banking cartel. And so they have a system now where the federal government goes into debt, because it always spends more than it takes in. Well, not always, but 99% of the time. And in order to finance that debt, it's got to channel it through the banking system. That's called monetization of debt. And the banks turn this debt into money. And basically the citizens end up paying, really literally paying interest on what's called the money. What we have in America is not money, really. It's debt disguised as money. It's extremely immoral.
Well, you mentioned the word immoral. Let's go there for a minute. I know that in your article you talked about this, and you mentioned the biblical basis, if you will, for why this is immoral. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure, sure. And I'll just give your listeners a heads up there. That's, you can find that at the Colorado Christian University. There's a think tank with that called the Centennial Institute at Colorado Christian University. And they have a monthly publication called the Centennial Review. So if you just Google Centennial Review, Colorado Christian, it'll bring up that article. And the idea is that you have to have honest weights and measures. Let's stop and imagine a world without any money and you just want to trade some fish for some meat. Right? You have to balance the scale somehow. You can't put your thumb on the scales and pretend there's more meat than is actually there. Right? That's an immoral act. It's an act of theft against the person on the other side of the contract. Well, eventually, a society's developed money over time as a means intermediary between these terms of trade, so what's called a medium of exchange. So you didn't have to luck into somebody who wanted meat if you wanted fish, you know, and make the trade. You could actually work for money and then trade the money for the fish or the meat. So economy started taking off, but if the money doesn't have a stable value, that's like putting your thumb on the scale, isn't it? It's like robbing one person of some of the physical value of what they've produced. So that's the idea behind the immorality of debased currencies, the immorality of unsound money. It's really a theft. It's a breaking of a contract relationship that this is worth that and that is worth this, and you know we're making trades based on that. I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but.
Makes a lot of sense to me. It makes a lot of sense. What it does, it allows for that. It facilitates the theft, and so
yeah.
There's a lot of ways that in essence, it is immoral. More ways than one. One, it does not allow for an honest exchange, if you will, because there is no intrinsic value to compare, even. So they can basically manipulate that any way they want as to the way those values are. I mean, you look at, for example, the precious metal prices today. Would you call those a fair market pricing of the metals today compared to the fiat currency?
Well, it's very hard to see what is worth anything. When you have a fiat currency, an ounce of gold is always an ounce of gold, right? It's a physical quantity. You always know what it is. But in terms of what that's worth in terms of a printed currency, when the price of that gold is going up, the physical ounce of gold hasn't changed. The price of it has gone up only because the value of the currency has gone down. So fairly valued or not, an ounce is an ounce. As long as the gold is pure.
Yes, and
so it's not the value of the gold that's not fairly valued, it's the currency that's depreciating.
Exactly my point. And I've heard that there's only one cause of inflation. We get deceived by this so much, by the media, by the government. I mean, it's been a dumbing down of our society that goes back for multiple generations. So, I mean, when I was born, I mean, people were so dumbed down on this issue that they had no concept of what was causing inflation. You'd hear everything imaginable blamed for inflation. But there's only one cause for that inflation, and that is the artificial money.
That's right, Terry. Milton Friedman had a great way of saying it. He said that inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, and he also said inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. But yes, in my career as an economist, I've seen the front pages of the Wall Street Journal. I've seen academic journal articles blaming it on the labor unions, on employment, blaming it on the farmers, on the price of farm products, blaming it on the Arabs and the price of oil. Well, those are just symptoms, right? Those individual market prices are symptoms of the inflation. They're not the cause of the inflation. The inflation is basically the printing of money, only they don't really print money anymore. They just print the electronic digits and stick it in the bank accounts.
Well, at some point here, I think we ought to bring up the Constitution. what is it, Section 10 of Article 1 of the Constitution? Talking
uh-huh.
about not entering into alliance, confederation, grant letters of mark, coin money, emit bills of credit, says no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque or reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts.
Absolutely.
Has that ever been repealed?
No.
Then how are they getting around this?
Sleight of hand. How did they do this? I really recommend Geord Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. It has a pretty deep history of who and what and why they did what they did. But basically, Congress took their constitutional authority and duty and just dumped that off on a private banking cartel called the Federal Reserve.
Well, I've heard different arguments about this. I've heard, you know, that they didn't have any language in there prohibiting them from borrowing that money from somebody else that was not a part of the government, and that that was a sleight of hand. But then I've heard also that they had no right or authority to convey a power that they did not themselves have.
Yeah, well, they do have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. They just didn't have the authority to give that to someone else. That's like saying they have any of the enumerated powers granted to the federal government by the states. Any of those enumerated powers, if you think they could just privatize the banking system, any of those enumerated powers you can imagine, that they could just outsource any of them. And, of course, that's not the case. That's not the point of having a federal government, the constitutional republic, where representatives of the people.
Well, as highlighted in your article, the Constitution doesn't say print money. And, in fact, the exact prohibition against issuing bills of credit, what is this fiat currency that if it's not bills of credit or IOUs that they are issuing?
Well, they're simply these days, they're called Federal Reserve notes. You know, at one point there was a paperback currency, but yet the currency itself represented gold and silver in vaults that you could then trade it in. The original U.S. dollars were actually convertible into gold and silver, so they were simply a representation of it. The paper was simply easier and more convenient to carry around, right? It enabled commerce, but the gold standard really just started crumbling very soon after the Federal Reserve was instituted. Roosevelt did a lot of damage to it, and then finally Nixon got rid of it entirely. So it's not about Republicans or Democrats. It's just about, you know, thieving politicians, if I could.
Well, weren't they having this problem because they had issued their own script, if you will, back at the time of, you know, just before the Constitution? Weren't they having some serious economic issues in this country because of the failure and the debasement of the script that they had issued? And wasn't it that fact that they put this in the Constitution and went to a strict gold and silver coin situation that turned the economy around at that time?
Yes, that's mostly true. As I understand it, what they did was just printed a bunch of what was called continental dollars. And the phrase, you know, Terry, exists to this day. I don't give a continental. It's just kind of a way of saying I don't give a damn. I don't care because it's not worth anything. And that comes from the founding era pre-Constitution, where the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation, the Confederate government under that, tried just printing a bunch of currencies to cover the war debt, and they realized that devalued that currency very rapidly, and they were unable to secure credit, engage in international trade and commerce. They couldn't, you know, none of the European countries would accept American debt, and so they saw the damage of that. So in the subsequent Constitution, they wanted a much harder currency.
So we got conned out of that. We got tricked into, if you will, a fiat system which does not have any intrinsic value by these banksters, and we got tricked into allowing them to set up a private central bank. You know, how does this Keynesian system benefit that whole process for those banksters, and how does it work against the people?
Sure. The where Keynes comes into this is his whole idea of government running debt, i.e. spending more than it's collecting in taxes, and then monetizing the debt. So, and they, it's monetized through this banking, private banking cartel. So that's the connection, is that this private banking cartel enables the government to spend way beyond its tax revenues, and just then the banks monetize that debt. So it just started off very slowly, as everything does at first, and eventually came to today, where they're right now the Federal Reserve is monetizing approximately $85 billion a month in government debt, turning into money through the banking reserve system. That's about $1 trillion a year. It's just inconceivable.
Well, what intrinsic value are these private banksters bringing to the table to justify saying that they're owed a debt?
Well, when the money has to run through them, they get their spread, right? There's a buy-sell spread on everything, and the dollar bills you hold in your hand is really representative of somebody else's debt. That's why in 07, when people were unable to keep paying their mortgages, that unraveled so fast because, you know, your paycheck, literally, somebody that's listening to this right now, maybe they're getting so many dollars a week or so many dollars a month in a paycheck, and it's U.S. dollars going into their bank account. But the fact is, somebody in California or Detroit or Florida didn't pay their mortgage, and eventually that whole thing started unraveling because, there was nothing backing it. So when people started defaulting on their debts, that worked its way through the currency system. So the Fed is frantically trying to print more currency to make up for the defaulted debt. It's not likely to have a very good outcome.
I believe it was Horace Greeley. I could be wrong about this, but I'm thinking it was Horace Greeley that first made the comment about man's darkest hour was when he realized that there was a way that he could gain a living without earning it.
Oh, yeah. And even going back to the Roman emperors just towards the end of the collapse, when they realized that, I can't remember who it was that said it, but basically the Republic is over because the people have realized they can vote themselves bread and circuses. And that's, we're living through that here. Money is supposed to be a medium of exchange. You're supposed to have produced something of value, gotten some currency for that, and then use that to trade with somebody else who has produced something of value. The old fish and meat thing. If you think you can just have some fish without having some meat to trade for it, that's just a theft.
Well, we went a lot of years up until 1913 without having an income tax, without having this central bank situation. They had kind of got it in and it got kicked back out, and we know that Andrew Jackson fought against it, but
right.
The point is people today believe that the taxes that they pay goes to pay for the military and all the other services that are provided by the federal government. But we're also told that all of the income tax goes to pay the interest on the fraudulent debt that these banksters have convinced people they owe.
I don't know if the numbers are that extreme, but certainly a large portion of all the income taxes paid is simply just interest on the debt, which is income to the debt holders, which is mostly the banks.
So, but we went, 130 years or something like that without having that system, yet we had a military, The main part of the government was covered by other taxes other than income taxes. We did not need those things, so why do we have them? If we don't need them, if it's not necessary to run the government, why do we have them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just let me back up for a minute because now I'm a little bit confused. Am I speaking with Terry or the Red or who?
This is Terry.
Okay, Terry, I want to make sure I had your voice right in my mind. Terry, the... from the founding up until the Federal Reserve, the total tax revenue in the U.S. economy, and this is just the best economist estimates we can have. We didn't have good data all the way through. But the total tax rate in the economy, that's federal, state, and local combined, was somewhere around 5 to 7% of the economy. So for the first 125 whatever years, we fought and won a war of independence against the greatest military power in the history of the world. We fought our own internal battle against slavery. We expanded coast to coast and border to border. We transferred from an agrarian to an industrial society, became the economic powerhouse of the world, built railroads and bridges all around the United States at a 5 to 7% tax rate. Now, just consider that. When people tell you we need more money for infrastructure spending or we need more money to stimulate the economy, you know that our fastest economic growth occurred when the tax rate total, federal, state, and local, was between 5 and 7%. Now, we're a long ways from that.
So what's where's the rest of it going?
Well, it goes to bread and circuses. It's primarily transfer payments, unfunded liabilities, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I think most of your listeners understand that. Most of their income is not going to justifiable constitutionally authorized federal government enterprises. It's primarily going to transfer payments of one kind or another, which is not only unconstitutional, it's immoral. And furthermore, it does more damage to the recipients than it does to the people it's taken from.
So that being the case, what's the motive of the central bankers to do this?
Well, I don't know any central bankers personally. At this point in time, you know, exactly 100 years after the founding, I believe a lot of them believe this. You know, they think this is the only way to run an economy, that a modern economy needs a central bank, that the central bank is there to help everybody, and, you know, that's their job, is to stabilize the economy. And even though all the data shows they're making it worse, there's a good body of economic theory showing why it can never work and cannot work and shouldn't work, they're still stuck with their Keynesian paradigm. And to this day, you go to most universities, and 85-90% of the college professors, even in the economics department, are Keynesian/Marxist. And they won't recognize they're Marxist or admit to it, but that's fundamentally what Keynes is, income transfer from one to another. That's a Marxist concept. So there's just now, and those professors have taught their students, and those students grow up to become professors, and they've taught their students, and now we've got third, fourth generation professors who just deeply believe this.
Well, I think we've got a pretty good definition of what the problem is, and we like to focus on solutions in this show. Can you talk a little bit about solutions?
Solutions are fairly easy to outline in theory, Terry, but very difficult to implement in reality, because the people have to take charge back of their money. They've got to demand sound currency. They've got to start with perhaps a full audit of the Federal Reserve so we have full transparency. I think Ron Paul ran a bill through Congress that had a lot of support, but they never really did anything with it to audit the Fed so we could at least get a picture of what's happening. I mean, a lot of the stimulus and bailout money, frankly, was laundered through the European banks. My gosh, they were bailed out. So we need a full audit of the Fed and what it's been doing, and then work eventually from there to eliminate it. I believe we need to eliminate the central bank one way or another, and maybe that can be done legislatively, or maybe it can just be done by alternative currencies springing up in the marketplace. I don't really know how it will look.
Well, Red, you've been quiet for a half an hour here. Do you have any questions for Dr. Prentice or comments? You might need to unmute.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I couldn't help but think when he mentioned 1913 getting the income tax and the Federal Reserve Bank. Most people think that our ineffective, do-nothing Congress is something that has just happened to us in the last few years. the Do Nothing Congress was pretty much in place in the late 1880s, and I have encountered a lot of people that talk about how bad our Congress is. They say, "Oh, it's the worst we've ever had." Well, I beg to differ, because I think that we had some Congresses back there, and like in the 1890s and such, that were as bad or worse than what we've got today. And it really, you know, I don't think much of our Congress today, but I have a hard time blaming the Congress because the American people are getting, you know, they're not paying attention. They're not staying up to date on things. They don't value truth like they should. And so our Congress today is a little different than it was back in the late 1800s and such, because back then, that's when the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and such were really putting together their plans, and the people didn't have the methods or the communication capability that we have today and such. And so today we really don't have that much of an excuse like they had back then. We had about 35 million immigrants in this country that were trying to become Americans, and a great percentage of them on both sides of my background. People came from Germany and Sweden and such, and they were just my grandparents. Were still speaking their native tongue back there when I was a small child, and I remember that. We don't have, you know, we don't have the excuses that they had then. We have nobody to blame but ourselves, we the people. And so that's about all the comment I want at this point.
Red, I agree with you on one of your points. I disagree on another, which we might discuss, and they both tie into something I'd like to go back to Terry with on what do we do about it. You're certainly right. We have the Congress that we voted for, correct? So the ignorance of the people is simply reflected now in the ignorance of the Congress, although I'm not quite sure it's fully ignorant Congress. I believe there's a lot of what you would call evil there as well.
Yes, I agree there, and of course, I guess I should have said the American people today are more gullible, and they really don't have a good excuse. They've got excuses, but I don't think they've got the excuse that that the people back there 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, they had a better excuse. And of course, that's I come from Montana, and of course, Montana was one of the states that was brought into the Union long before they were ready to really be part of the Union, and that was so that the robber barons and such could stack the Senate in particular with their people, and they weren't, they were scoundrels. There was a bunch of them, and all of these western states had that problem when they came into the Union. The robber barons were right there, and they managed to stack the deck in the U.S. Senate and keep some legislation from being passed such as, you know, Lindbergh, Congressman Lindbergh, tried his best to warn the American people about the Federal Reserve. But, you see, he didn't have the resources and such that we have available today. And he was up against the scoundrels that had, they owned most of the senators from the West that they had brought in, you know, brought in states where they brought them in too early before they were ready. It's just another piece of the history that we're having to deal with today.
Yeah, I think that's, if you don't mind, a bit of a sidetrack, because that doesn't really help us with what we're doing. Certainly the people back then had the excuse, or at least the reason, that they didn't have the full access to communications, right? Today we have all the communications, but we have no education. So yeah. I'm not quite as hard on my fellow citizens as perhaps I might be, because I just see them as being uneducated. And so what do I do? That's my job. I educate people. That's your job. We educate people. And so really it goes back to what Terry says. What are we going to do about this? If we start with educating people, they've got to understand the truth and the reality of what is going on, and then they can start making local actions, starting at this very small scale at the local level with your local school board, then with your city council, and work your way up to the state and then the federal government. But it won't be solved at the top down.
Well, you know, I wrote in the article that I put out a couple of years ago on Sound Money that basically the Federal Reserve granted the private bank and cartel the power to control our money, and that quickly became superior to our government. And I said that any government subordinate to a bank is no longer sovereign. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, you know what, Terry, it goes back to Jefferson's quote. And I'll actually bring up the quote itself. Quote, "The central bank is an institution of the most deadly hostility existing against the principles and form of our Constitution. I am an enemy to all banks, discounting bills or notes for anything but coin." So that's Jefferson right off the top. Of course, Hamilton disagreed. He wanted a strong central bank, but the Jeffersonians won that battle, and then it was fought again through Andrew Jackson and some other things. But the idea is that the people are simply just ignorant of all of this. They're not taught true history. They're certainly not taught market-based economics, my gosh. They're not even taught to think anymore. So I spent quite a bit of time in the public school system and the school reform movement teaching at a public charter school here in Colorado, where we sort of run our school outside the State Department of Education system, even though we're connected to them. We have our own control of curriculum and school board. And I think any of the parents that are homeschooling, involved in maybe sending their kids to religious schools, but be careful as to which one, because they're not, just because it's a Christian school doesn't mean it's got the right economic founding. I think our churches have done a terrible job of educating our people about the nature of property rights and what is real money and, you know, how does an economy work. But anything outside the sort of traditional public school system is a start towards re-educating our citizens, and we have to really start there because they're being so deeply brainwashed starting in kindergarten.
Well, what you're not familiar with is this show. First of all, I read one of his many books that he wrote is titled "The Church Deceived," and we've had
a lot
of the unrest.
I'll have to get it.
We've had a lot of the unregistered church leaders on our show, like Greg Dixon and Robert McCurry and John Weaver, and people who have been fighting this really ruse that they put on about churches having to become corporations, which is, there's no such law that says that in order to be tax exempt. The church is already tax exempt, and there's no law that says they have to become a 501c3. But yet that's been, tricked upon them. It's been a ruse put upon them ever since back in the time of Andrew Johnson. So Red's kind of one of the people who have been outspoken on that issue for for many, many years now. But let me ask, I've got a caller who's got a hand raised. Would you like to take some questions at this point?
Sure, let's go.
Area code 678, you have a live mic. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, this is Pat Shannon. How you doing, Terry? I know I'm a week early, but your subject matter intrigued me so much I had to tune in tonight.
That's great, Pat. You are welcome to join this conversation.
Well, first of all, I've got to ask Dr. Prentice. I suspect that maybe his twin sister might have been Paula, with whom I was in love about 30 years ago. The actress Paula.
She spells the last part of the name differently. I spell it T-I-C-E. She spells it T-I-S-S. No relation.
Yeah,
nice try.
I couldn't resist. Anyhow, it's intriguing. It's refreshing to me to hear two guys, you and Terry, talk about the subject matter that finally fits right into my venue, because so few people can discuss the subject as you two have. And I have for 30 years, and Red knows this. He and I go way back. But one of the things that I think so many economists, and especially the new generation, neglect because of their miseducation in school, is that the Constitution doesn't mention the word currency. The Constitution only mentions, as you two did, about the circulation of gold and silver coin. And currency, of course, was a banker's dream. It was a method by which to deceive us down the road. You know, I'm sure Dr. Prentice knows very well, and Terry too, that they corrupted the currency, the paper currency, long before the Fed ever came in. That's what forced the Fed to come about. But my point is that what we neglect to understand, and I hope that you would expound upon this, Paul, that the states in the early days, of course, controlled the federales, and that's how Washington State's so small, because of something called apportionment. The federal Raleighs, they couldn't do anything until the states approved it, because the money all flowed up. But once the Fed came into power and the counterfeit money began to flow, all the money flowed down from the top, and that's when we lost control. And for 30 years, I have written that is the power that's hiding in plain sight, that the counterfeit money allows them to do all of the things they want to do. And for that reason, in my mind, there has not been any taxpayers' money either. If the government can create all the paper and, as you said, type the few buttons in and credit today, then if they can do that, then why do they need our tax money? My question.
Well, they're finding out they can spend way beyond our tax money, aren't they? So, yeah,
or steel beyond.
Yeah, and keep in mind that the printing of money and the ultimate—not yet, but in this age right now—but the ultimate inflation coming from that printing of the money is a hidden tax, and even John Maynard Keynes recognized that. It is a tax. It's a very stealthy tax. It's a very immoral tax. It redistributes wealth from borrower to debtor, from debtor to borrower, and it just. It's not going to have a good outcome.
No, and of course the power that it wields, the internal power for them to arm alphabetic agencies that have no business being armed to enforce unconstitutional laws, that's what creates the police state. And I have maintained for a long, long time that the whole seed, of course, is the counterfeit money that they're allowed to create.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Pat, I actually make an argument in other places, and just see if this might be useful, that government spending, that's the tax. Whether it occurs from printing money, from going into debt, or collecting revenue, that's the tax. Because if the government commandeers 50% of all the resources in the economy, whether it does it by printing currency, whether it does it by floating debt, or whether it does it by taxing income or property, if it commandeers 50% of the economy, that's a 50% tax. Now, maybe they only collect 25% tax, and maybe it's 10% inflation, and the rest is some other things. But the fact is, if you just measure it as government spending as a proportion of economic activity, that's the true tax, because that's the commandeering of private resources that's occurring. So I don't know if that's something that you're interested in or not.
Certainly. Yeah, to me, that has always been the lifeblood of the counterfeit government has been, of course, the counterfeit currency. And that's. But anyway, I just wanted to say hello to Terry, and I'll be back on next week. But you guys really have touched me when you're talking about my favorite subject now.
All right. Thank you, Pat.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, I see this as my favorite subject, not because it's the thing that I want to be talking about, but because it's necessary to handle this issue before we can achieve redress of any other grievance, because the theft that has been going on for over, at least the last 100 years has resulted in them taking what we here can have frequently called a tithe to the counterfeit false god. And they've taken that tithe and they have purchased infrastructure. They have purchased by either bribery or by threat control of every major institutional organization, whether it be judiciary or legislative, education. They've used that theft of our money to take control of all of those arenas. And as a result of that, the people have lost their standing and have no means of getting it back. And now they squeeze the economy just the way they did it initially. They had to drive it into a depression in order to keep the middle class, or really what I would call the working class, people. They put them in a position where they could not resist what was going on. And that's basically why I believe today the economy is being falsely driven into a hole, if you will, and put into the bind that we're in economically, is because they don't want the working class to be able to resist or fight against this control that they have bought or they've purchased with the theft of our production. And until we find a way to break that vortex, that tithe that they have forced everyone into by the police state, until we can break that, how can we possibly expect to achieve any redress of any other grievance, whether it's constitutional or unalienable rights that they're violating? How can we do that in the absence of sound money, which is the only way that I can think of or know of, where we can, in fact...
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. If you desire to speak to the host, please press 1 at any time, and the host will be notified that there is a caller in queue. Otherwise, please hold and you will be able to listen to the show.
Crosstalk on your system here.
There you go. I think you've got a live mic now. I was having some trouble. I think that was Red calling back in. And I need to figure out which one of these to give him a live mic on. I think that one's it. Red, I think you've still got another line open, Red. So you've actually got two lines into the show now. So, Dr. Prentice, I got on my soapbox. I'm sorry, but I kind of wanted your response to that.
You know what, Terry, if it was only a tithe in the biblical sense, if it was only 10%, it wouldn't be so bad, would it? But it's 30-40%, and when you include the hidden taxes of regulatory takings and regulations where the costs exceed the benefits, the American public is working for about 50 cents on the dollar right now. So it's basically become a 50% slave state without even realizing it. Which is a horrible thing, and people don't fully appreciate it or understand it. When they steal your money or the value of your production, they're stealing part of your life. They're stealing the 40 hours of work that you put into it that it'll never get back. And that's the ultimate theft, is the theft of your humanity itself. And if it was only 10%, I wouldn't be so upset, but it's huge. It's 40, 50% and perhaps even more now.
Well, I totally agree with you, and you know, I've had this debate with some people who should have the very knowledge that you just came out with. But when I've talked about the inflation being the biggest tax we may have, they want to resist calling it a tax, and I'm not sure why so many people can't really grasp that. But I'm glad to see that you know that this is something you're giving me some confidence when you say that.
Well, you know, really good economics, what would the Austrian school calls reality economics, is really just common sense dressed up to look good in an academic environment. So yeah, most people have common sense, and you know, economics, you know, you knew that when you were in first grade and you were trading your lunchbox in the sandbox. You know, you were trading your Snickers bar for someone else's potato chips. You were involved in economic activity and you knew that trade made you better off. I mean, economics is just natural human nature. So if we just can, you know, just stop teaching at it in such a way that that makes it so confusing to everybody, they have to pay us to explain it back to them, you know, just get back to the human nature aspect of it, or what we call Austrian economics, reality economics, and it's intuitive to most people.
Well, you know the old saying about when you first learn something, it's basic, and then after you kind of got a grasp on it, well, actually, it's advanced until you learn it, and then it becomes basic. And so you mentioned the word radical in an earlier conversation with me, and I told you you were biting off a big chunk with me, because I perceive myself, after trying to go out and talk to people and educate people on things, you know, even my wife gets a little annoyed with me when I start talking about things, because she realizes that so many people are going to resist the radical nature of the things that I'm talking about. Well, let's talk about politics for a little bit here, because if a politician resists the concept of sound money, is it radical to want to vote him out of office? Is it radical for us not to accept the lies that the politicians are playing upon us? Is it radical to want to recall these people and to literally throw them off as far as having any governing authority over us if they can't at least allow us to have a proprietary ownership of our money?
Well, you know, Terry, they call us radicals, but to me, we're the regular folks. They're the radicals. They've stolen the Constitution. They're breaking every legal constraint, every moral law, everything possible. So, you know, we appear radical because they've become mainstream, but we're just normal. I mean, you know, the Tea Party movement and the Patriot movement, the people that understand the right to their property, and part of the right to their property is the right to a sound currency and the right to the fruits of their labor, of their income, which was common sense, you know, for a long, long time, and still is if you can break past the scare tactics that they put on us. We're not radicals at all. We're just normal people. I mean, the world, just in the time that I've grown up, I'll tell your audience right now, I'm 67 years old. I don't recognize the America that I grew up in. Okay, when I grew up in, you know, it was post-World War II.
Well,
and even though
I didn't
recognize it.
Pat's not on with us anymore, but he coined that phrase for me, red, white, and blue fever. And I had that red, white, and blue fever up until, you know, 5-6 years ago. I think I started losing it after 9/11. And I have some people would perceive my opinion on 9/11 as pretty radical, because I see it as a controlled demolition, and I believe that it was set up that way deliberately in order to attack our unalienable rights. And I think the terrorists, the real terrorists, are the ones that are behind fomenting the wars, the ones that are behind the attack on their Constitution, the ones that are really wanting to knock God off of the top of the pecking order. I believe those are the real terrorists, and I believe that those are the people, very people we've been talking about here tonight, as far as these banksters, these people who own the Federal Reserve. I believe that's the radical nature of where I'm at, is that I look at that and I start talking about those people, and all of a sudden people perceive it as someone having an attitude against the country or the government or anti-government. I'm not anti-government at all, but people perceive it as being a radical opinion, because I believe that the people who are driving this government, the ones that are behind it, the shadow government, are the real terrorists. And that puts me in the radical category for a lot of people.
Well, yeah,
any
Sure. A limited government of enumerated powers, that was the norm, right? And I grew up with that red, white, and blue, and I understood that. But in the meantime, it was being undermined and had been undermined for decades. And even in, by the 50s and 60s, it was already well into the process of where it is now. I would recommend to the listeners a great DVD called Agenda, Driving America Down. It's a wonderful DVD that traces the history of this, and I think we can get too much focused on this event in history or this person or that institution. I think we have to go to a much higher level and really see this in the biblical terms of a battle of good against evil, a battle of really profound implications that's been fought, of course, ever since the Garden of Eden, and America was a shining light on the right side of that battle for a long time, but it succumbed during that slow progressive era starting in, you know, sometime around just after the Civil War, going through the late 1800s to the early 1900s, that entire progressive era where they were progressing away from the Constitution, which means they were regressing back to having a society where people were being ruled by people instead of having sovereignty, self-sovereignty. I really do see it at a much higher level than that, and we could change presidents, we could change political parties, we could do this and do that, but if we don't get the understanding of good and evil correct and be able to discern it and call it what it is and identify it, we're just going to be changing the riders on the carousel, but we're not going to be changing the direction of the carousel at all.
Well, Red, I think he's touched on some topics that you'd like to comment on. You have an open mic, by the way, if you're not muted on your end.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Yes, we do.
Well, I'm unmuted then. I really enjoyed this tonight, and I've been aware, of course, in my 84 plus years, I have seen a lot of things happen in this country. And I was able to discern that there was some very, very evil forces and arrayed against us. And of course, I've always been a kind of a history buff. I liked my history classes in school. Dr. Paul has said that downhill started after the Civil War, and I've said many a time that the ink wasn't even dry when those people signed the Constitution and pledged their fortunes and their sacred honor and everything. That ink wasn't even dry, and there were people who were trying to undermine the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all of that. It has taken us over 200 years, about 230-odd years, to get to where we are. And of course, I always like to try to find the bottom line, and of course, I think I found the bottom line when I read in the scriptures that Christ was baptized of John, went into the wilderness for 40 days, and when he came out of the wilderness, Lucifer took him up on a high mountain and showed him the kingdoms of the earth. Now, those kingdoms represent the wealth and the power of planet Earth, and in Luke 4:6, he said, "These were presented to me." He claims the kingdoms of the earth. And so I think that's the bottom line where we have to start when we try to understand all of this. And I had just read something here in the last few days on the Internet, people talking about what we were going to have to do. Militia, and all of that to try to take back, get our lawful government back. And I read the whole thing. It was rather lengthy, and not once did they mention the fact that during the, oh, they talked about the Declaration of Independence and the 3 or 4 or 5% that supported the rebels, the revolutionaries at that time. But no one wants to mention that the Revolution Army, they had a battle cry. And they said, no king but Jesus. We haven't heard that today, and I don't think we're going to go gain a lot, you know, perhaps, until we, you know, pick up on what they were using back then as their source of power. And so I think that at this point in time, Terry, Pat, Shannon, and Dr. Paul here and myself, what we're doing basically is we're establishing a record as to where we are personally, where we are in this picture as individuals, and which side we're on. I want to be on the right side when I depart this old carcass of mine. I want to be on the right side, on the other side. And so I think that I've established somewhat of a record, and I know that Terry and the recommendations and the things I've heard about Dr. Paul here, I think he understands what I'm saying. And so you know, I think that's the bottom line, and I think that you know, we've got to kind of watch ourselves and talk about the two different kinds of education. There's true education and there's false education. And that term education has been so misused and so, well, it's just we have to know that there is the two kinds, and we have to know that there's two kinds of patriotism. There's patriotism, people like we on this program. We are concerned about our country, our nation. And our patriotism is for the best we're looking out for the best interests of this country. The false patriotism, of course, is the kind of patriotism that gets nations in very, very serious trouble because people give their allegiance and their patriotism is focused on a government. And when people, when their patriotism is focusing on government rather than their country, that's a false patriotism, and we have far too much of that in this country right at this point. And so I've rambled on a little longer than I should, so I'll turn it back to you fellas.
Okay, so thank you very much. I'll give you some interesting quotes maybe your audience will be interested in on the idea of education and true education. The first thing, I'm wondering how many people know what the original Great Seal of the United States said as it was originally proposed by Jefferson and Madison and Franklin. The original Great Seal of the United States said, was the saying that defined America was, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. That was on the Great Seal of the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court would find that unconstitutional, and probably they're actually in the process of finding the Constitution itself unconstitutional. So we've come a long way from that understanding, that biblical paradigm of seeing the world through those forces. I've got a quote here from a gentleman, Thomas Hodgkin, in 1823, long before public education became the norm. And public education, of course, was started by the progressive Marxist Dewey in the late 1800s. But here in 1823, I'll put the quote, "Men had better be without education than be educated by their rulers, for their education is but the mere breaking in of the steer to the yoke," unquote. So that's what's happened here with this government education system. It's really just designed to channel people and to brainwash them into becoming serfs or slaves of the state and to accept a 30, 40, 50% tax rate as the right way to do things, you know, instead of realizing they were born with liberty and they ought to have at least 90, 95% the fruits of their labor. So it's really the education. Here's some quotes from Karl Marx, okay? Karl Marx, quote, "The education of all children, from the moment they can get along without a mother's care, shall be in state institutions at state expense," unquote, straight out of the Communist Manifesto. Here's from Vladimir Lenin, quote, "Give me 4 years to teach the children, and the seed I have sown will never be uprooted," unquote. Joseph Stalin, quote, "Education is a weapon whose effect depends on who holds it in his hands and at whom it is aimed," unquote. And then Benito Mussolini. Now notice these names, of course. These are all our favorites from the 20th century, aren't they? 18th and 20th century, 19th and 20th century. Benito Mussolini, quote, "It is the state which educates its citizens in civic virtue, gives them a consciousness of their mission, and welds them into unity," unquote. So for all of you homeschoolers, church schoolers, private schoolers, charter schoolers out there, you're doing the right thing. You've got to break away from this education by the state. We're just being educated to become more docile slaves. So that's just food for thought, some quotes.
Yeah, that's a lot of thought.
It kind of sounds like George Bush, you know. I mean, really, when you have No Child Left Behind and the U.S. Department of Education just kind of taking the Federal Department of Education, nowhere enumerated, as just centralizing and taking over just as fast as you can breathe almost.
Well,
so
I got
it's not about Republicans or Democrats.
No, it's not at all. I mean, and frankly, we frequently talk about the left-right debate being a smokescreen. Because when you look at the pyramid and the fact that the warfare state supports the top of the pyramid just as much as the welfare state does, you soon realize that both of them are increasing the debt and have done nothing to bring us back to constitutional governance. So I'm a Republican not because of the Republicans of politicians, but because of the platform of the Republican Party, which most of the Republican politicians ignore. And we fight against this left-right debate because it's part of that Panametra census. It's part of that bread and circuses. People get so convinced that somebody out there is doing something that they fail to act, and that's what we've got to do. We've got to educate the people to bring them back to a point where they realize they cannot rely on an election to solve this problem. People are going to have to start judging the law, and they're going to have to start acting to hold these people accountable, or else we're never going to get this thing turned around. And, of course, we need divine providence to be a part of that. If they don't keep God at the top of the pecking order, it's real simple, and I've put it this way a number of times. If God's not at the top of the pecking order, we have no unalienable rights because they are creator granted. Comment to that?
The Bible is so full of stories of nations that have fallen from God's ways, and what has happened to them has never been pretty. I don't know why people think it'll be different with America, but.
True.
No, there's precedent throughout history of this. There's been some great work recently done on sort of drawing the parallels between the Roman Empire and America and the modern day America and the parallels from 2,000 years ago. And they're just They're mind-boggling, just mind-boggling. It's as if somebody, I think one historian once said that history doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it surely rhymes a lot. You know, we're really living through the same thing that was happening to Rome, and it doesn't mean it has to have the same outcome. We have free will, and we have power and control to change that, but we're certainly heading towards that at this point, including to the thing that more so than the Romans shaving their currency, debauching their currency, just what we're doing now, electronic shaving of our currency, of their overtaxing the people to the point where the laborers can't pay for the military campaigns, same thing Rome did, to the point where the ruling class, the ruling political class, became totally immoral and degenerate. And you see that now with our political ruling class becoming increasingly disconnected from the population and behaving in incredibly immoral and degenerate manners. And now you've got, you know, Wiener's Wiener running again for mayor of New York. You know, my God, he'll probably win. So the parallels are just shocking, shocking. But we don't have to end up like they did. You know, we do have choice.
Well, we won't have too many choices if we let them kill our electoral college and truly turn this into a democracy. I mean, we already have pretty much a dualocracy as it is. But you know, if we let the people that are concentrated on the coasts and the big cities take control of this country, you know, we are absolutely doomed, and we are so close to that tipping point where that's exactly where we're at, that we will never be able to turn it around. And all we can do is really claim, you know, pray that the day of the Lord comes sooner rather than later.
Well, I talk with a lot of people that see it, and they argue that we can try everything we can to stop from going off the cliff, but if we recognize that we've already gone off the cliff, we are in free fall politically, economically, culturally. And so at that point, our best choice is to, what do we do? How do we prepare for the crash landing? And how do we then prepare the world we're going to build out of that? And that's one way of looking at it. I'm not fully convinced that we've crossed that tipping point yet, but certainly we're very close.
Red, any thoughts on that?
I don't know what I would add here. I had forecast the demise of the USSR, and people would say why, and I'd say, well, there's never been a nation yet that has violated the first and second commandments that has ever survived. And, of course, I'm forecasting the demise of the federal God, as I call it, here in this country, because we are basically, violating, the government is violating the first and second commandments. And I just don't think that this government is going to survive, violating God's law. And so Dr. Paul has said we're in a free fall, and we are, and the landing is going to be unplanned. Nobody's going to know how this landing is going to be. So it's really vital that we alert as many of our countrymen as we can, and that's what this program is all about. Alert our countrymen to the danger, and when we hit bottom and have to bring it back, try to bring it back, I should say, and I think we will, for the simple reason that what has happened in the in Russia since the demise of the USSR, if we can do as well as they've done, we'll be very fortunate. And so you know, I just I think we're making a mistake if we try to say how it's going to come out, because we don't know. There is so much evil and so much, miseducation out there that it's going to be a tough one. And with God's help, it don't have to be that tough, but we're going to need God's help, I can assure you. So you fellows are doing a good job, and so I'm better off staying quiet, I think. So it's back to you, Terry.
Well, Doctor, if you don't mind, I kind of feel like I need to get on my soapbox again and take just a minute, and then you can jump in. I was blessed this week to be able to spend a few hours of time walking and talking with a fellow known as Brother Nathaniel. He is a monastic novice, if you will, which means he is a part of the Christian Orthodox Church, and he has, you know, a good amount of knowledge of what Putin has done. And one of the things that has helped turn Russia around, if we look at the formula for subversion of a nation, which, you know, the Marxist formula is certainly based on subversion. One of the first things that happens is that they want to destabilize the religious foundation of the society, because then they can get people believing lies. They can, you know, once they get that destabilization done, then they can begin to make things seem normal that should not be normal, like immorality and, you know, sexuality and violence and things like that. They normalize those things and desensitize you. But they start with breaking down that religious foundation. Well, what a lot of people don't realize about Putin is that he is a member of that Christian Orthodox Church, and he has reestablished and protected the Orthodox Christians in Russia of late, since the falling of, you know, of the bloc that was there. One of the things that happened during World War I and World War II were that there were tremendous attacks on the Orthodox Christian Church as well as the Protestant churches in both Russia, first during World War I, and then in Eastern and Northern Germany during World War II, where the Orthodox Church and the Protestant churches dominated. They were the principal areas of attack, and then they were put under the communist regime, the atheistic regime that was installed, because the Tsar in Russia, at the beginning of World War I, was in fact protecting the Orthodox Christian Church. And one of the purposes why that war was fomented was to break down that religious foundation and install an atheistic communist regime. And then that regime was put over the people in Eastern and Northern Germany for the same reason, to break down that religious foundation. Putin has restored that. And that, I believe, is a major reason why Russia has been doing as well as it's been doing. So I'll shut up and get off my soapbox. But I shared some of that. That was actually some of the things that I was aware of. But when talking with Brother Nathaniel, he reiterated these points to me regarding Putin's faith and how that has made a tremendous difference over there and is making a difference. So just keep that in mind. And I don't think that's something we've really talked about much here. We've talked about why they fomented those wars and the attack on that, on the Orthodox Christians and the Protestants, but we haven't talked about how Putin has actually provided a hedge of protection, if you will, for the Christian Orthodox Church there, and how that is making a great impact over there. I'll shut up.
Well, yeah, that's way outside my area of expertise. It is possible that Putin is playing a role in perhaps getting some institutional protection of the church over there. That does not mean he's anything more than what I believe he is, which is a KGB killer. So we could disagree on that. I just don't have much information on that itself. The broader issue is correct, that the attempt to break down the fundamental Judeo-Christian biblical morality of the culture and all the institutions that have grown up over 5,000 years to allow that to flourish. That is what's behind all of this, and that is very evil. And it's, you know, I can even quote an atheist. I can quote Ayn Rand on what's wrong with the money end of this, and she's got some great quotes on that as well. And she doesn't come to this from a biblical perspective at all, except that she was driven out of the church in Russia when she saw the church getting in bed with the communists. So, you know, that destroyed whatever faith she might have had. So there's a lot more to it than that, and perhaps you're right, and perhaps not. I don't really have expertise in that area.
Well, there's no question about Putin's history. You know, that's the environment he came out of. There's no question about that. So, I mean, we're in agreement on that. It's just that, you know, his faith has changed since some of those early days, and the fact that he has provided the reestablishment, if you will, and strength of Christian orthodoxy over there has really helped that nation.
Uh-huh. I just wonder what's actually being taught in the Christian Orthodox faith, because the church was so deeply corrupted from, you know, 1917 on. I just don't know what the remnant is there, but perhaps. So anyway, that's really not my area of expertise.
Red, any comment on that?
The church in Russia was corrupted, but I couldn't help but think of, and some people will probably take exception to what I'm saying here, but the Seventh-day Adventists, they had a pretty active church in Russia during the days of the USSR. And they got along, it seemed, quite well with the powers that be, the political, and the leadership of the church would go over and I remember this very well, because I had some friends that were very much involved in that denomination. And they brought a lot of this to my attention. And I'm talking about 50 years ago, of course. When the USSR went down, a lot of the records, government records over there in Moscow and in Russia, were opened, and there were a lot of people. Our government sent a lot of people over there to go through some of those records to see what they could find of interest. And one of the things that they discovered was that the leadership of the denomination, that Seventh-day Adventist denomination in Russia, were all government agents, and they were well versed in how to deceive the leadership coming from the U.S. and that type of thing. And you know, I remember when it happened and when it came out. Of course, the demise of the USSR was in December of 1991, which isn't all that long ago, a little over 20 years ago. And so that's, you know, that's the nature of a tyranny. That's the nature of an evil system. Deceit and deception, that's their tools of the trade. You know, we are living in that type of a political climate right as we are doing this program. And I've got to tell a kind of a funny little story. A guy called here to my home, and my wife answered the phone. I was out, and he was taking a political poll. We'll have an election of some kind here in Washington State this fall, and he wondered how we were going to vote. And my wife says, "Well, we don't even know what." Is going to be, you know, what candidates there are and all of that. And of course, the poll taker, he come to the conclusion my missus was up in years. She's up there. And he said, "Well, is there anybody else there that I can talk to?" And my wife said, "Well, you can talk to Obama." That's just a joke around this place, anyway. And I'm sure there are people out there that'll laugh about that. I was even surprised at my missus to come up with that one. But she said the guy was just silent. He just didn't know what to say next. But then he ended up, he kind of laughed about it too, I guess. So. You know, we've got a lot of listeners to this program tonight, perhaps, that we don't know about. And back in the 70s, I remember people cautioning me, and they'd say, "Well, Red, you've got to be careful about what you say on the phone, and because you know your phone is tapped by the government." And I used to chuckle, and I'd say, "I hope they're listening. They're not going to hear anything but the truth, and that's one way I can talk to them, and they can find out what the truth is, because that's what they're going to get if they listen in on my conversation." And that's what's happening tonight. I hope the government's listening. I hope those schemers, those plotters, those gangsters, political gangsters, I hope they're listening, because... you know, they're going to start questioning whether they've got true education or false education. And so I usually look at things a little different than others because I remember the 1930s, and I have looked back many, many a time. And I have thought about how the crash of 29, I've studied that thing, and I'm convinced that in the 20s, we had some very, very loud voices. We had Henry Ford, we had Lawson, we had... Father Coughlin. We had a bunch of people, and we only had radio, electronic communications, and the printed page. And I think that the powers that had put the Federal Reserve on our backs and all of that, I think they became very nervous, and I think they dumped our economy. They had the power to do it, I guess. And, boy, I'll tell you, in the 30s, people weren't worried about the political that much. They were worried about getting something to eat for the next meal, and especially people with families and such. And so they accomplished what they set out to do, I think, and then topped it off with World War II. And so here we are. We made it this far. If you'd asked me back there in the 70s and 80s if I wondered how long we could survive on the course that we were, and I would have never guessed that we would make it to 2013. So I don't set dates. I don't set. I'm not prognosticating when this is going to come down. But I know that it is the federal God is going to come down. So because I know there is a God who is watching, and he's going to step in at some point. So I'll turn it back to you, Terry.
Well, Dr. Prentice, I know you've got something on your mind there. I'm sensing it.
How did you know? Red brings up a couple of points there. I don't agree with everything, but certainly there's no question the federal government is listening to this. We all know that, right? They're on our websites. They're in our email. I just found out a couple of weeks ago they're scanning and taking pictures of every single postal envelope that goes through U.S. Post Service now and stashing it in a data bank somewhere. So, yeah, they're collecting everything from everybody. And the key words we're speaking, even to speak against the Federal Reserve, put you on their terrorist watch list at some level. That's not really my concern. I would be hoping that there'd be ministers listening. I would be hoping that there'd be some people in the church, ministers and rabbis, listening that could understand that they have made a devil's bargain when they traded off their tax exempt 501c3 status in order to muzzle their political views. That was basically, in my opinion, a satanic bargain, and they lost that bargain because what they are is completely muzzled against talking or speaking truth and doing any kind of political activity. Back in the founding, you know, this. Preachers would get up in front of their congregations and pull off their cloak and reveal a Revolutionary War soldier. You know how different that is now between the church being so cowed from speaking on these issues and speaking truth, just because they covet the 501c3 status. And of course that's true more of the conservative, libertarian or grounding principles churches, because the left-wing churches get away with it all the time, don't they? The Jesse Jacksons can speak at any left-wing Marxist progressive church in America, say anything he wants, and nothing ever happens. But James Dobson tries to get up and speak at a local church, and they'll threaten to pull the 501c3 status. So I would just urge the clergy out there to just consider that bargain and maybe just, you know, accept that you might get a little less money, but you'd be a lot freer if you would give up your 501c3 status.
Well, and you know, they've got political prisoners in that arena the same way as they do in numerous of the other freedom fighter arenas. Like Von Nothaus or Schaefer Cox or Edgar Steele, or you know, the list goes on. But the one I was thinking about was Kent Hovind. You know, he preached openly against the IRS and the banksters, and they trumped up charges on him and put him in prison. And, he's a great creationist preacher. He was a paleontologist, an expert on dinosaurs, and, it found that all of that observable data pointed directly back to the timeline that's laid out in Scripture, from the scientific perspective, or rather than the religious perspective of the evolutionist. They didn't like that either, because he was one of the great voices against that. My point earlier was this, and that is that Americans have been a willing target of subversion. They have allowed the religious foundation to be subverted here, and that the need, a great need, is for us to work backwards in the way that we've been ambushed by the Marxists and the subversive techniques that have been implemented by the platform of Marxism. So we've got to get back to judging the law, and to do that, we've really got to keep God at the top of the pecking order, because His law is the greatest law. The real highest law of the land is God's law, and the Constitution supported that and reiterated it. And in essence, one of the things that I'd like to do, and I know I won't stop you from making a comment to what I just said, but I think we've got about 25 minutes left to go, and you wanted to talk about property rights. We haven't really gone there, but I think it's perhaps a good segue to go over to that, because we've been talking a lot about sound money and the banksters and all of that, but that's not the only way that they've been attacking us. They've been attacking us really property rights, which is, you know, the pursuit of happiness originally was the term property. And they've been stealing our production. The enjoyment of our production has been stolen, and that really is what happiness is about. And that happiness is to enjoy our property, which is the result of our production. And they've attacked us through the UN. They've attacked us through Agenda 21. They've attacked us through in the environmental issues, EPA, Fish and Game, Endangered Species Acts. There is a whole slew of ways that they have attacked us, including weather warfare, which, you know, we don't need to get into the details of that in this conversation, and I don't know what your perspective is. But my point is that the money side of it has facilitated all of these other attacks. And so there is a lot of attack going on property rights. Even the foreclosures that have occurred, really, to some extent, could be argued that it is a conspiracy to take over all private property rights. Any comment on that?
Sure. Private property is of the essence of our very humanity, is it not? That's what we are. We are property creators and producers. Otherwise, we're just cattle grazing on a field. I mean, that's what we do. That's what it means to be human, is to create and produce and trade the fruits of that production. So that goes to our core nature. And that was understood by the founders, and previous to them, John Locke's treatise on government, about 125 years before Jefferson's Declaration, mentioned life, liberty, and property as our sort of trinity of fundamental God-granted creator-endowed rights. And Jefferson just wanted to go that one better and say life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which by nature and naturally included property rights. So it was very understood at the time that property was part of that. And it's been a very slow, gradual erosion of those property rights, i.e. an erosion of our humanity that we've been facing. If you think about it, that John Adams had a quote that basically the property rights, he had a biblical perspective. He said, if thou shalt not covet and thou shalt not steal were not commandments, they must be made inviolable precepts in every society. So thou shalt not covet and thou shalt not steal, well, that's a statement of property rights. How can you coveting? That means to want something that's not yours that belongs to your neighbor. Thou shalt not steal, that implies ownership. That's a property rights statement, isn't it? So those very two commandments are statements of property rights. They're thousands of years old, and they go to our very core humanity and our core commandments from God as to how to behave as a human being. And if you look through the federal budget today, you'll see perhaps 70-ish% of federal government spending is about coveting and stealing, isn't it? It's unbiblical, it's immoral, it's unconstitutional. Go through your state spending budget, you'll find maybe 50% or so of your state budget coveting and stealing, maybe 20-30% of your city or county government coveting and stealing. It's just become part of the political body, part of the politic. But it is completely unbiblical and completely immoral and completely inhuman. It's against our human nature. To do that. So I have an Aristotelian logic, kind of a two-step sequence proving that Marxism, first of all, is against God's creation. Then having proved that Marxism is in fact satanic. So that's what I think we're up against. We're up against principalities and powers here that are, just have to be seen at a very high level. And, you know, God created man with a fixed human nature. Part of that fixed human nature is a desire for private property. And if you doubt that, just go to any two-year-old in the world in any language, and one of the first five words they're going to say is mine, right? It's part of our human nature. But Marxism is against private property, and the Communist Manifesto, quote, the theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property. Well, if God created man with a fixed human nature, if that human nature is desire for private property, Marx is against private property, therefore Marx is against human nature, therefore Marx is against God's creation. So this is not rocket science here. And then once you accept that God, the Marxism against God's creation, you could go, all things against God's creation are satanic. I think most of us would agree with that. And we've just proven Marxism is against God's creation, so therefore Marxism is satanic. Do you have any questions? I mean, it's just Aristotelian logic. So property rights underlie all of our rights. How can you have a right to self-defense if you can't own something with which to defend yourself? How can you have a right to freedom of the press if they can come and confiscate your printing press or your these days your internet blog? Property rights underlie all possible rights. So they're really key to our system. So that's enough about that. Well, don't you think?
that was great syllogistic reasoning. I love that. I'm into that. That's awesome. I'll have to listen to this archive myself a couple of times just to hone my own tools on that a little bit. That was very good.
Well, I'll send you the. I've got a little PowerPoint. No, actually, I've got a page on it that I wrote, and I actually posted that on my. On one of the economics classes, classrooms that I taught at a public charter school here in Colorado Springs, and we discussed that a lot. Never get away with that in a regular public school, but
Red, you
I don't
didn't
think a lot
that,
of the clergy understand that. Go ahead.
No, they don't.
Yes,
they don't.
Yes, I enjoyed that, and I'll tell you, it's just... I was thinking how many are there more of you out there than what we know about? Are there new minds and lives coming into this line of thinking, the true education? You're not by yourself, I hope, in the education arena. Are you in touch with a lot of others in this country that think like you do?
Sure. That's part of the work we do at the Mises Institute out of Auburn. We run high school education programs. We run programs for teachers of high school. Students and so there's quite a bit of us, and we are starting to have some impact on the mainstream economics programs around the country, just a little bit here, but we're making a beachhead anyway, so getting some start. No, I'm not alone. There's hundreds, or across the world there's even thousands. I've met Austrian economists from Guatemala, from a former Soviet Union, from Ireland, from Brazil, from everywhere. So there's a kind of a current. Because it's reality-based, and it's true. It's truth, and truth will win, and reality can only be denied for so long. So, in my little world of educating about property rights and limited government and how a market-based economy works with the pricing system, there's much more activity there in the education world than there was when I was growing up. So I think there is some hope at that end.
That sounds good, but one thing that bothers me, and that is that we have so many people that think that the federal God at the top is the real culprit, and our local governments they've got cleaner hands and all, but. That is not the case from my own experience. And here locally where I'm at, I was not affected by it, but I know the fellow that lost the property. They taxed him out of his property. He had some very, very choice industrial property. He was up in years. They taxed him out of that property, and the county took title to the land. And that's just been in the last two or three years. And the local people, they thought that was great, because then the county turned around and sold a portion of it. I think, if I remember right, it was 200 or 300 acres. And I think they sold a portion of it, and they had a nice profit, of course. And so the it isn't just the Washington, D.C. gang. It's the state and the state house and the local county courthouse and right down into the cities and such. And so it permeates the entire system from top to bottom. And so our property rights just I don't know. It's a bad situation, and I prayed the last prayer that you find in the Bible, in the Book of Revelations. The Apostle John closed off. He said, "Even so, come, Lord Jesus." And of course, we're not going to wait for that to happen. We're going to continue to fight for that which is right and stand for what is right and speak out for that which is right. And until our King, our Messiah King does return. And so that's the record that I hope to be able to stand on when I face the great judge of the universe. So I'll go back to you.
Okay, you're quite right. It's not just the feds we have to worry about. It's much closer to home. It's right down in your local city council. The right of eminent domain is being used by cities and municipalities all across the country. That, in fact, the Kelo abomination against property rights was the city of New London, Connecticut, just wanted to steal some person's private property. That was not federal. It wasn't even state. It wasn't even county. It was just the city of New London. So, yeah, we have to watch out for these people. They're everywhere. And we have to educate the population so that we stop electing these people. I think your comment on America's worshiping government, the government's become their god. At the Centennial Review, which is the publication from Colorado Christian University that kind of started this interview, where I did an article, a July article on sound money, the previous article in June, I highly recommend that as well, and you can find it on the same website, is called by Benjamin Wicker. It's called "Do Americans Worship the State?" And it makes exactly your case, Red, that Americans have switched from worshiping God to worshiping Caesar. And that's not likely to end well either.
It's sad, but it is so true. And that is people's source. But, you know, a number of years ago, I traveled the country for 30 years, speaking tours all across the country. And we stopped in California at one of my wife's sister's, older, and they were he was retired railroad engineer, and they were members of been long time members of an evangelical church, and they wanted us to go to church with them on Sunday. This was 25 years ago, and they had a Sunday morning. They asked for anybody with a testimony that they wanted to give publicly, and there were a couple, and then there was an elderly retired minister, and he gave a testimony, and he was so appreciative of our government, how he was getting Social Security, and that this was making him and his wife have a better retirement. And I almost got sick listening to this because I thought, my goodness, this is a retired minister, and he is worshiping a false god. And this is happening, and a lot of people aren't sensitive enough to things like this to recognize what it is, and they need to you know, get their act together in their mind, their mental condition improved to where they recognize when they hear this kind of thing. I was probably the only one in that congregation of 300 or 400 people, perhaps, and I hope I wasn't the only one there that sensed the problem here, but I probably was, and so that's what we have to overcome. Back
well,
to you.
They are deeply ignorant, not stupid, but they're ignorant in the sense of lacking knowledge. And they should know better, and they need to know better. So they're ignorant, and therefore they've been deceived. So they're part of this great deception, and it's a long story of the progressive Marxist takeover of America. It goes back, you know, to literally the mid 1800s, and the church has been a big part of that in many forms throughout. And it's just tragic that so many well-meaning Christian ministers, as well as Jewish rabbis and other faiths, are so deeply ignorant and incredibly deceived about the nature of reality. It's just shocking, and that's part of the problem. You know, that this church used to be the strength of American civic life. It used to be the bastion of liberty, of inculcating our citizens in the principles of American exceptionalism based on limited government and private property rights and free markets. And now it's gone completely the other side. Either that, or it's become pacifist and an enabler, and just by its pacifism, just, you know, praying and waiting for Jesus to arrive. Well, I still think, you know, the World War II saying of praise the Lord and pass the ammunition is still very valid. You know, you have to take action as well as prayer. It's one is inadequate without the other. So.
I remember back in the 60s and the very first of the 70s, I was a member of an evangelical church. I was on the church board. It was kind of a rural church, not a large church. I was the senior adult Sunday school teacher, and I thought I was my dad was a country preacher, and so I was around the Christian faith all my life, and then things started to the IRS recruited me. They got me thinking, and I had had a collision with them in the 50s and another one in the 60s, and then they came around again in the early 70s, and I got to studying, and I got to thinking, and so I've made a 180-degree switch. It didn't take long, and I wasn't welcome in that church that I was a member and a board member and a Sunday school teacher. I wasn't welcome because I was saying things that made people uncomfortable. And, of course, I probably wasn't as smart as I could have been. I probably wasn't, I didn't have enough wisdom to know how to present it. But then again, I don't think, I think that what I was saying was as true as could be. It wasn't accepted. And even my own family and my wife's family, they're all basically Christians on both sides, and they have some real problems with this kinfolk of theirs that has spoke out. And I'm used to it. I don't let it bother me because I've done my homework, and I happen to know that they have not done theirs like they should, and they don't want to listen. Because I mess up their program, I guess. So I'll go back to you. We've got about 6 minutes. I don't know what happened to Terry, but we've got about 6 more minutes, I think. And so I don't want to waste your time. We really appreciate having you here.
Well, sure. It's been my pleasure. Keep in mind that thinking and educating is hard work. You know, it's a lot easier to emote. You know, just ask any parent of a 2 or 3 year old. So we're kind of got an uphill battle to fight because it's hard. You know, to fight for liberty, you have to understand the case. You have to read maybe Skousen's 5,000-year leap. You have to be completely immersed in the history and the understanding of it all. You have to have read Cicero and Plutarch and go back to Augustine. And, you know, it's just not an easy thing to do. But the church itself has been deceived and has been part of the deception, and we know who the great deceiver is. And it all goes back to the satanic Marxist takeover that's happening. So that's just the way it is. You know, if Plutarch could have said in 75 A.D., here's what he said, quote, "The real destroyer of the liberties of the people is he who spreads among them bounties, donations, and benefits." Plutarch, 75 A.D. Right? You'd think these people would know that, but they don't know it. Talk to your clergyman. Who is Plutarch? Never heard of him. Talk to him about Cicero. Well, maybe he came across the name somewhere, but he didn't really know what he was saying. So they just haven't been educated. They've been deceived. So thank goodness for shows like this that give a chance to for people to listen, at least a platform for people to speak and listen and think and investigate these ideas and find out what is true and what is false. And hopefully we'll start turning this thing around, or at least preparing for the post-crash rebuilding, perhaps. You know, I'm not sure what side some of your listeners are on of that debate.
Well, Terry, are you there? We lost Terry. I'm not used to closing these things out. And I've got calls. People have been trying to call me, and I don't dare go. So I've got call waiting, and it doesn't really work that well when I'm doing a talk thing on the radio. But you know, I know that we, the people of this country. There is a difference today in the thinking and the reception that we're getting. There's a difference than what we had, with Y2K back 13 years ago. There is a switch. There is a change, and a welcome change. It's just that I would sure like to see... This change, I'd like to see it really, you know, pick up some speed. Obama talked about change, and people are coming to the conclusion that the change he was talking about isn't good for they themselves. It isn't good for their country. And also, it has given us, I think, a more fertile field in which to work. And I don't know if you would agree with that, but I'll give you a chance to voice your opinion here.
Well, I agree that what we call the remnant, you know, the biblical remnant, is waking up. But it certainly is waking up, and that's all to the good. And we see that from the Tea Party movement to various things. So that's some encouragement there. I just really would wish and hope and pray that our not just our civic leaders, but in particular our church and synagogue leaders would really get a grasp of this thing and start fighting for true liberty, not just this god of government.
This has been invaluable. This 2 hours has been well spent, I think, and I would suspicion that we have an audience out there that have been pretty attentive and paid a great deal of attention to what is being said, and of course the archives are going to there's going to be people tapping into the archives on this, and I just this is part of the. Of the awakening. This 2 hours is going to be one of the pieces in this thing where as we put something back to, you know, try to put something back together again. And so I want to thank you. My best is goes with you because you're in a position. You're an educator, a true educator, and anything I can say to encourage you to continue, anything I can say. And so I think we've already hit our time limit. At least my clock shows that we've limited. So, Terry, are you there? Or am I going to be the last voice here? I guess I'm going to be the last voice until another time. Everybody, listen up, because things are happening and it's all for the good at this point in our game, in what we're doing. So thank you all.